Welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, April 4th through Saturday, April 6th, feature guest conductor Klaus Makkola and cello soloist Saul Gabetta. The program includes music by Sully Zinoviev, Batteria in its United States premiere, Cello Concerto No. 1 by Shostakovich, and after intermission, Shostakovich's Symphony No. 10. Here are program notes by Philip Huscher on Sully Zinoviev's Batteria, a work lasting about 11 minutes. When he was 16 years old, Sully Zinoviev, who played guitar in a rock band, saw a video of the Hungarian pianist György Zsiffra performing music by Franz Liszt. Quote, "It was as if wallpaper had been torn off the wall, revealing a window to an open landscape," he later said. "The euphoria and the virtuoso performance left a fanatic impression on me. To have the ability to inject so much art into a single moment, the entire spectrum of life." Growing up in his native Finland, Zinoviev was not part of a musical family, but music held a major presence in his childhood. He remembers Mahler symphonies blaring in the background while he played Lego at his grandparents' house. Zinoviev studied at the Sibelius Academy from 2010 until 2015, and then at Karlsruhe's Music Academy, where he worked with the German composer Wolfgang Rimm. Rimm's Sotto Voce was given its U.S. premiere by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in 1999, with Daniel Barenboim conducting from the piano. The first classical work Zinoviev composed was a modest piano concerto, one that was quite different from the full-fledged piano concerto he wrote in 2019, premiered by Víkingur Ólafsson with the Finnish Radio Symphony Orchestra and Klaus Makkola in January 2022 after being postponed by the pandemic. Zinoviev's previous concertos, both composed in 2017, are Der Leiermann for violin and orchestra and Der Welt ein Tor for cello and orchestra. Among his recent works for orchestra are Hit and Run, a short piece for orchestra from 2021, which received its first performance in October in Bamberg, conducted by Jukka-Pekka Saraste, a double concerto for violin and piano with strings that was premiered last March in Espoo, Finland, and Un Grande Sospiro, a tone poem in the mood of Edvard Munch's painting The Scream and inspired by Sibelius's Seventh Symphony, which Makkola introduced with the Tapiola Sinfonietta in 2019. Makkola also conducted the premiere of the orchestral piece Wiegenlied with the Oslo Philharmonic in 2020. Zinoviev has written a number of pieces of chamber music, including a new piano trio, A Love Song, which was premiered on February 28th in Vienna. And as Zinoviev's catalog continues to grow, the range of his musical interests also branches outward, including Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. "If there's one opera composer we all need, it's Wagner," he recently said, to Hans Zimmer's soundtrack to Christopher Nolan's Inception. And here is Sully Zinoviev himself on Batteria. Batteria, which I composed in 2016, continues my exploration of vigorous, virtuosic music, but it also steers my expression towards more extra-musical topics. Throughout the piece, the rhythms are strongly tied to the pulse, from a primitive crochet to a more relentless, clock-like tick. The rhythmic aspect is crystallized in the flash cut to a belligerent march for percussion and brass just before the climax. The arrival, positively hedonistic in its fullness at an E major chord at the very height of the piece, acts as the firing shot for the final ecstatic sprint against time towards the finishing line. Acting as milestones in the overall scheme of Batteria, which last about 10 minutes, are three loud chords like church bells influenced by a wave of dramatic acts of terrorism in Paris, Brussels, and Nice that took place while I was composing the piece. Dedicated to life, à la vie, Batteria is not, however, a political statement. Rather, it is purely and simply humane art from one individual to another, privately and personally. Words by Sully Zinoviev and program notes by Philip Huscher on Zinoviev's Batteria. And now on to Dmitri Shostakovich's Cello Concerto No. 1, a work lasting about 28 minutes. Dmitri Shostakovich made three trips to the United States. On the first, in 1949, he was asked to play the scherzo from his famous Fifth Symphony on an upright piano in Madison Square Garden for a crowd of 30,000 curious spectators. The last, in 1973, just 2 years before his death, brought him to Evanston to accept an honorary doctorate from Northwestern University. In between came a month-long stay in 1959, arranged as part of a cultural exchange allowed by the new Khrushchev regime. Shostakovich and several other Russian musicians traveled from New York to a number of major American cities, including Philadelphia, where Mstislav Rostropovich played the American premiere of Shostakovich's first cello concerto. Rostropovich had given the world premiere of this new concerto only a month before in Leningrad. Composed early in 1959, the concerto marked the beginning of Shostakovich's brief but intense fascination with the solo cello, which was inspired by Rostropovich's exceptional playing. Over the next 6 years, Shostakovich wrote a second cello concerto, also dedicated to Rostropovich, and reorchestrated the cello concerto by Robert Schumann. Aside from an early lightweight piano concerto, which he wrote when he was in his 20s, Shostakovich became interested in the concerto form relatively late in his life and as a direct result of his contact with important performers like Rostropovich or, in the case of the two violin concertos, David Oistrakh. A second piano concerto was written for his son, Maxim, who played it for the first time on his 19th birthday. The small number of concertos in his vast output is surprising, considering that Shostakovich produced 15 symphonies and 15 string quartets, 36 film scores, several opera and ballet scores, and a great many songs, choral works, piano pieces, and arrangements of other music, including, of all things, Tea for Two, which became the Tahiti Trot. The first cello concerto begins with the solo cello playing a four-note motif, G, E, B, B flat, and that will surface again and again throughout the work. At one point, the motif is transposed and its intervals tightened to produce C, B, E flat, D, a variant of the composer's personal motto, D, E flat, C, B. The music is lightly scored with important solos for the horn, the only member of the brass section Shostakovich included in the orchestra. The tone throughout is lively and energetic, but not lighthearted. The following movement, although not slow, marked moderato, suggests repose and introspection and is crowned by a long singing line from the cello. Lyrical solos for the horn are prominent, and near the end, the celesta and the solo cello engage in dialogue. The soloist then begins an extended cadenza, which Shostakovich indicates as a separate movement, placing a Roman numeral 3 above the word cadenza. Although Shostakovich still maintains the cadenza's historical definition as a brilliant unaccompanied virtuosic display music for the soloist, he has now elevated it in size and function to its own movement, moving even beyond its role in his earlier first violin concerto, where it linked the slow movement and the finale. Here, too, the cadenza leads without pause into the last movement, a tight, brief, ferocious allegro that concludes by recalling the concerto's opening four-note theme. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Dmitri Shostakovich's Cello Concerto No. 1. And now on to the Shostakovich Symphony No. 10, a work lasting about 55 minutes. We're told that a recording of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23 was still on the record player when Joseph Stalin died on March 5th, 1953. It was the last music he listened to. And it's hard to know what this merciless leader heard in some of the most sublime and civilized music ever written. Perhaps there's a clue in Shostakovich's own words as recorded in testimony. Music illuminates a person through and through, and it is also his last hope and final refuge. And even half-mad Stalin, a beast and a butcher, instinctively sensed that about music. That's why he feared and hated it. Shostakovich, the composer Stalin hated most, had learned through personal grief and public humiliation of this fear. twice since Stalin had assumed power in the 20s, Shostakovich felt the brutal power of Stalin's attacks, and twice his artistic impulses had been devastated in ways scarcely equaled in any other time or place. Stalin's first attack, prompted by an impromptu visit to the Bolshoi Theater performance of the opera Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, plunged Shostakovich into a crisis of conscience, changed his career forever, and at the same time altered the course of Soviet music. The popularity of his written response to Stalin's criticism, the Fifth Symphony, and his increasing fame around the world only made Shostakovich the inevitable prime target of the intensified attack of February 10, 1948. This time, the official language of reprimand was stronger still, the accusations very specific, and the pressure to conform impossible to ignore. In response, Shostakovich not only withheld his first violin concerto, but he decided to write no more symphonies during Stalin's lifetime. One of the major projects he did undertake was a set of 24 preludes and fugues for piano, inspired by a composer with no suspect political leanings and a spotless reputation, Johann Sebastian Bach. In March 1953, Shostakovich awoke to the news that Stalin was dead. His first professional act was to release the works he had withheld from performance. That summer, he cleared his desk and began a new symphony, which he wrote at lightning speed. Tatiana Nikolaevna, who gave the premiere of the Preludes and Fugues, claims that the symphony was actually begun in 1951 while he was writing the piano cycle. Even so, it seems clear that he worked extensively and urgently on the symphony only after Stalin's death. This is music of a new beginning, at once summing up all that Shostakovich had to say in the form of a symphony, releasing everything that the years of Stalin's oppression had buried, and anticipating a fresh and enlightened era ahead. The Tenth Symphony was performed in Leningrad in December 1953 to a mixed response. In March 1954, the Moscow branch of the Union of Soviet Composers even called a special three-day conference to debate this important symphony, already recognized as a pivotal work in the history of Soviet music. Many didn't know how to place it within the context of social realism that had governed Soviet composers since 1932. Some were put off by its apparent pessimism. Finally, in the elaborately ambiguous language that often springs from political gatherings, a young composer, Andrei Volkonsky, pronounced the Tenth Symphony an optimistic tragedy. Soviet musicians quickly noticed, in the beginning of the symphony, a strong resemblance to the opening of Liszt's Faust Symphony. Shostakovich's friend and biographer, Dmitry Rabinovich, insisted the reference was intentional. Early in his career, Shostakovich loved Liszt's music. He later cooled too many notes. From those first strands of sound, sunken and mysterious, the music rises step by step toward a massive climax some two-thirds of the way into a 25-minute movement, and then retreats. The massive arch form, unerringly paced, is one of his finest accomplishments, and it achieves the kind of epic stature that eludes so many symphonies written in the 20th century. At the conference held by the Union of Soviet Composers, Shostakovich admitted that this movement didn't realize his dream of a real symphonic allegro. We don't know what music Shostakovich measured his own against, but the sense of drama unfolding, of music developing before our eyes and ears, recalls the landmarks of the classical period, the works that defined symphonic allegro forever. The scherzo that follows is concentrated fury, brief and to the point. Like much of Shostakovich's angriest music, it's set against a relentless moto perpetuo with screaming woodwinds, flaring brass, and abundant percussion. The ensuing allegretto begins as a dialogue between two kinds of music, one introspective, the other more assertive and proudly bearing the composer's musical monogram. Stalin's death freed Shostakovich to write music so personal that it bears his very signature in the notes on the page. This dialogue is interrupted 12 times by the gentle calling of the horn, a mysterious five-note summons waiting for a reply. Although it resembles the horn theme from Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, which Shostakovich was studying at the time, we now know that it's really another musical signature, that of Elmira Nazirova, an Azerbaijani pianist and composer who had studied with Shostakovich at the Moscow Conservatory, with whom he corresponded frequently during the summer of 1953, and with whom he was in love. As in life, their themes call ambiguously to each other across this movement, and then Elmira's signature disappears from the music. Elvira did attend the premiere of the symphony in December 1953. She later said she felt the composer's eyes on her throughout the performance. They rarely corresponded after that. When the horn theme goes unanswered for the last time, the finale begins, cautiously at first, and then picking up speed and courage. This movement has often puzzled listeners because it answers the severe and despairing tone of the early movements with unexpected cheerfulness. It's this music that makes the 10th Symphony an optimistic tragedy. But even the affirmative final pages, where the DSCH motto is finally pounded out by the timpani, can never entirely sweep aside all the questions and fears that have been raised before. Shostakovich's personal triumph, however, is unequivocal, for this is the first of his symphonies that Stalin would never hear. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 10. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.